This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. Want to bring IXL to your school? Learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE.
Welcome to the Cyber Traps Podcast. I'm Jethro Jones, coming to you this week from Utah. I'm the founder of the B Podcast Network and author of the book School X and How to Be a Transformative Principal. I'm also a former principal at all levels of K-12 education.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Frederick Lane, an author, attorney, and educational consultant based in Brooklyn, New York. I'm the author of 10 books, including most recently Cyber Traps for Educators 2.0, Raising Cyber Ethical Kids, and Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads. Jethro and I have teamed up to bring timely, entertaining, and useful information to teachers, parents, and others about the risks arising from the use and the misuse of digital devices.
Over the coming weeks and months, we'll be talking to some of the world's leading experts from the fields of education, parenting, sociology, and cyber safety. Join us as we look at what it takes to better navigate our increasingly high-tech world. For more information or to donate to our work, please visit centerforcyberethics.org.
The Cyber Traps Podcast is a production of the Center for Cyber Ethics, a 501c3 independent nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to the study and promotion of cyber ethics as a positive social force. Research, curricular development, publishing and media, professional training, and public advocacy. Hey there, Globetrotter. How are you, Jethro?
Yeah, Globetrotter. Just down in Utah. That's not much of a globe, but that's cool.
Yeah. Well, still, you got on the road a little bit. I'm looking forward to my trip to PPI in October. Actually, get on a plane again. It's kind of fun.
It is fun. And I've been down here in Utah doing some work for Ed Elements and connecting with a lot of districts. And cool. I think I found a potential guest for us. This district in Southern Utah told me about this thing called EduRoam, which is a statewide network that has been set up for educators so that an educator from any district can go to the site of any other district, log in through EduRoam, and have all the firewalls and security go back through their own district to make sure that they can get on the internet easily all throughout the state and have their own policies and practices in place as well. Isn't that a cool idea?
That's actually very cool. So sort of portable cybersecurity.
Yeah. And what I think is so cool about it is that when you're using your work laptop, like you have sensitive student information on there, and that won't be exposed to another district's network in case there is like some ransomware on that network or something like that. What it means is that you'll have your own safety and protections there on your computer, and you'll be able to keep yourself safe and according to your own policies. So
nice.
That sounds like a pretty cool idea. I thought that was a neat thing. So we'll hopefully be able to get him on the podcast to talk more about that.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to explore that because it obviously touches on the cyber traps piece, but then also this idea of cybersecurity, obviously all of the insurance issues that we discuss in terms of mm-hmm. vulnerabilities and liabilities and so forth. So really cool idea.
Yeah. Good thing we are such nerds and actually think that is cool.
What are we doing today, Jethro?
Well, we are recording this on the last day of Mental Health Awareness Month, which is the month of September. And A report came out just this morning, and we thought that it would be a great idea to talk about it. So the report is regarding a young woman named Molly Russell, who was a 14-year-old girl in London, and she committed suicide in November of 2017. And so the 5 years later, almost, the senior coroner ruled that her death was a result of depression and, quote, the negative effects of online content. And one, this is absolutely tragic and something that is 100% preventable. Because if it is the result of depression and the negative effects of online content, then we could have done something to save this girl's life. And that's part of why we do this podcast, is to make people aware of things that are bad that truly negatively impact our youth. And we want to prevent that as much as we possibly can.
Absolutely. I think that I was particularly struck by this report because it's one of the first, I think, that goes into such depth on the impact of these online platforms on a specific child's life. And so, you know, the five-year wait is something we need to talk about just from the start, because that's a remarkably long period of time for the parents to wait for the social media companies to provide the data that the coroner mm-hmm. was asking for in trying to assess the impact of what this young online on her eventual death. And, you know, there's so many things that the social media companies need to do better, but being responsive in situations like this should be at the top of the list. Nobody should have to wait 5 years to get this kind of information and begin to resolve some of the issues that this case raises.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that either the social media companies are ignorant of the harm that they're causing, which is bad and not good at all.
to put it mildly.
Yeah. Or they know the harm that they're causing and are dragging their feet so that people don't find out that this is going on and that they can keep their users addicted and stuck in these negative cycles. Those are two extremes. And I don't know which one's worse. I mean, I have an opinion on that, but they're both pretty awful.
Yeah, I think you and I share the same opinion with respect to that. And, you know, I think just a little bit more background on what the coroner's inquest found might be useful for people. And, you know, I think this show is directed obviously at the social media companies, but it's something that I think parents absolutely need to be aware of, because, you know, Molly... you know, what happened to Molly is not obviously going to happen to every child, but the harm that she experienced along the way is clearly something that could affect, you know, millions of children. Just as an aside, there was a child safety report that came out in the United Kingdom yesterday, I think, and it found that 45% of all children 8 to 17 had seen similar things to what this young woman saw. And so that's, you know, that's a tremendous exposure, and it raises all kinds of mental health issues. Now, specifically, what the coroner found when he was looking into the circumstances surrounding her death is that in just the last 6 months of her life, Molly saw more than 16,000 pieces of content on Instagram, of which 2,100 were related to suicide, self-harm, and depression. And on top of that, she compiled a digital pin board on Pinterest with 469 images related to, you know, similar or parallel subjects. And the key here is that whether she was out there seeking out this content as a byproduct of depression or what have you, that's one piece of it. But the real driver here is the fact that the algorithms that these social media companies use to suggest new content to viewers to keep them engaged were directly feeding her material that was sad or depressive related. And then Pinterest sent her an email that said, here are 10 depression pins you might like. And it absolutely blows my mind that you would create a what I'm going to refer to as a product, these algorithms, that would provide additional harmful content to someone with, you know, I think reasonable understanding of what the risks are of doing that.
Yeah. So let's break that down. And what does that actually look like? So 16,000 pieces of content on Instagram over 6 months is about 90 images or posts per day that she's reviewing. Now, if you've ever watched a teenager use Instagram, then that 90 posts in one day, that doesn't seem like that much because they go through so much. But I think my own experiences using Instagram and other social media, that when you see one thing and then you continue to be exposed to that, then you start to think about that more. And often when you go back into the social media app, then it may show you the things that you've already seen again. And so, you know, she may have seen those things multiple times. And then just seeing 90 depressive images every day is a pretty, that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of exposure to images, which are very powerful and more powerful even than text. As they say, a picture is worth 1,000 words. So those are things that we need to be thinking about as well, that looking at images as opposed to reading content about that, like just reading books about that or people's experiences is one thing, but seeing images, and you and I have probably seen the kinds of images that are on there that include images of self-harm and dark, disturbing images as well. Mm-hmm. That's really challenging.
It's super challenging. And as the coroner said, you know, it's reasonable to believe that when she was viewing this material, if she's already depressed and, you know, is in a vulnerable demographic, you know, every kid to one degree or another is grappling with changes as they go through mm-hmm. their tweens and early teens, you know, and for some it's very challenging. And the coroner correctly points out, I think, that somebody who is dealing with those kinds of vulnerabilities is likely to be more affected by this kind of content than others. And so it can create a dangerous spiral. Now, having, you know, talked to a number of different experts, and I have a couple of friends who work in the suicide prevention field, they are absolutely adamant that no one factor explains a suicide. That it is a very complicated topic. It's not easily parsed. And so you can't sit here and say, well, this happened because of Pinterest and Instagram. It's not that simple. But the point seems to be pretty clear that there are ways in which the social media companies are contributing to outcomes like this. And that's part of what we need to sort out.
And this is a very instructive example of a coroner taking the time, 5 years, to rule that her suicide was a result of depression and exposure to online content. And this is one of those things where once it is put in writing and once it is out there, like, now it becomes a precedent, a thing that we can go back to and say, you know, this happened here, this also happened over here as well. And I think, even though it's a long time to mm-hmm. wait, I think that it is worthwhile to start saying this contributes to somebody's suicidal ideation and eventual act, as was the case with Molly. And I think that that's a really important step, in my opinion, in the right direction to start documenting that it is contributing to harm to children.
Absolutely. And I think this is a great spot in the show to give a shout out to Molly's father, Ian Russell, who's become a powerful advocate for greater regulation of harmful content. And he, I think, really led the push to get these social media companies to produce the evidence and testify at the inquest about how this material could have been fed to his daughter when it's so clearly the terms and conditions of these social media platforms. And as a matter of fact, you had a couple of people who testified who actually apologized that she had been able to view this content. Now, interestingly, and we'll get into some of the legal stuff further on, that's going to potential liability issues for them in the United Kingdom. It doesn't raise them, ironically, in the United States because of our First Amendment and Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. But I've got some thoughts on that as well that we can get to in a little bit.
Yeah. One last thing that I want to say before we move on is her dad also said something. He said his daughter had reached out for help on Twitter to personalities with thousands or even millions of followers who would not even necessarily notice a tweet from someone like Molly. So this part of the story, I think, brings up two things. Number one, Molly needed to reach out to the right person, and reaching out to a random person on Twitter is not the right person to reach out to for help, right? So we need to help kids find the support they need that is appropriate, and not thinking that they can reach out to some random person on Twitter or some famous person on Twitter who has millions of followers. The second piece of that is that it cannot be incumbent on personalities with thousands or even millions of followers to be the one who responds and helps a child who's struggling, because that's not a sustainable model for help for someone. And so there needs to be more publicity about how to get help. And here in the United States, there is the suicide prevention hotline that people can call. And that is something that I suggest everybody has in their phone. You can call or text 988 in the United States and get help right away for free with no blockage. And then 988lifeline.org is the website that you can go to as well. And, you know, we need to help kids know where to go when they're experiencing this, and reaching out to random people on the internet is not the thing to do. You've got to get connected with someone who can help.
That's really, really good advice, Jethro. And as a standard reminder to folks who are listening to this, please go to the webpage for this show on cybertraps.com, where we have a bunch of different show notes, including contacts for the suicide prevention resources in the US, the UK and Ireland, Australia, and beyond. So certainly look at those, make sure that you pass them on to anyone that you think might find them useful.
So let's get into the the legal ramifications here and some of these other ideas that we can talk about.
Yeah, no, believe me, this is really kind of in my sweet spot for the issues that I've been working on in terms of free speech and the changes in society due to due to the rise of technology, social media, mobile, et cetera, and so forth. And I think when we talk about the legal issues surrounding all of this, one of the reasons that the social media companies grapple with this is that they are both protected constitutionally and statutorily in the United States. And those protections flow out from the United States to their behavior in other countries. So specifically, in the United States, obviously, we have the First Amendment to the Constitution, which provides for freedom of speech and prevents any regulation of the press. So whether or not you consider a tweet to be speech, or whether or not you consider Twitter to be publishing it as a press, quote unquote, there's clear constitutional protection for what someone says on these social media platforms. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, the origins of social media can be traced to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is something I really dove into in particular in my first book, Obscene Profits and Ties of the Online Adult Industry, because that was really the head start on all of this. But the basic concept of Section 230 is that if there is an online service like America Online, going back ways, or Facebook or Twitter, and they allow people to upload content, Section 230 exempts those companies from any legal liability for what people upload, which is just a huge protection. And a lot of people argue that what we see as the internet these days simply wouldn't exist because the scale of uploads is so gargantuan that there's really no practical way for these companies to completely prevent the uploading of harmful content. I mean, we've seen it time and again. You remember that shooting that took place? Well, which one? But one of them, I think, down in Florida, where the shooting was live streamed by the shooter.
Yeah.
And it still took like an hour, hour and a half, I think, for Facebook to get it off of its site. And by that time, of course, copies were floating all over the place. You know, so this is an illustration of the kinds of problems that arise. Now, people talk about Section 230 and they say, well, what if we, you know, basically eliminated that? What that would basically force companies like Instagram and Meta and Pinterest and all the rest of them to do would be to prevent the uploading of anything until it had been vetted. And so obviously that would bring everything to a screeching halt.
Yeah. And, you know, that we probably don't want that either, you know, and this is where like the answers to these problems are not easy to come to because we want to be able to post things. And, you know, there are policies that these social media companies have where they do take down a lot of stuff. And the challenge is that how do you know what thing is the right thing to take down and what thing is the wrong thing to take down? And, you know, that's where this becomes even more challenging, because in this situation, we can probably pretty easily convince people that self-harm images and videos and things like that should be taken down to protect our youth and young kids. And so then it becomes, well, what else should be taken down? And everything can't be all unicorns and butterflies, right? So we have to, we don't know the right things to take down and how to do it. And because many of these things are based on our own morals, then it becomes even more challenging of what should be taken down and shouldn't be taken down.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, even in the inquest, you had officials from Pinterest and Instagram saying, you know, this is complicated because some of the content in question was designed to be educational, was designed to, provide people with information, even though it's very disturbing. in its actual content. And, you know, you can think of myriad examples in which that might be true. And so how these websites moderate when there's nuances of information, that's not an easy question to answer, because we do want there to be, in an ideal world, a free flow of information. But the problem that we, I think, are seeing, and this is where we start to potentially get to a solution, is that these social media platforms are caught in a bind between their desire to use algorithms to promote content that they think their users will find interesting and their need to moderate content that could be potentially harmful. And by the way, this isn't really the show to discuss, worth noting that these social media companies like Meta and less so Twitter, but you know, Pinterest and so forth, have a huge mental health problem in terms of their moderators. That they hire, you know, they outsource their moderation to people who are spending hours every day looking at what Molly looked at, and understandably bad for them, you know. Yeah. So you begin to appreciate the scale and insidiousness of this problem. So I think we can focus at the end of the day on algorithms as the crux of the problem. I think it's interesting that in Russell's advocacy, but also because lots of parents are worried about this, that the UK is in the middle of drafting a pretty bill. And I'll be really fascinated to see what the final language of that bill is, which should probably be government stands, should be sometime this fall. But what they're thinking of doing, and again, remember that does First Amendment, so they've got much greater regulatory authority than the U.S. government does. But what they're looking at doing is requiring tech companies to do a professional assessment of the potential harm that their platforms may cause, particularly to children, and to put forward proposals that will mitigate those harms. So that's a really great start. And then when you look at penalties, one of the things that the UK is proposing is that there would be fines for violations of up to 18 million, 10% of a company's worldwide revenue. So if you just look at Meta, for instance, they had 118 billion in revenue last year. So an $11.8 billion penalty, I think, might get their attention.
Yeah. Changing fines to be percentage of income is that seems like a very harsh and powerful way to get some change to happen. You know, it seems to me that if you could, for example, take out algorithms that are specific for certain things, like in this situation here that Pinterest sent other depression pens you may like, take out the algorithms for those specific keywords seems like it could be a good step in the right direction, so that, you know, the algorithms the social media networks definitely use to keep people engaged in their platform. But if you could take away some of those algorithms so that they are not recommending the stuff that is harmful, that could be a step in the right direction. Doesn't take away the content. It doesn't take away the the educational nature of some of that content, but it makes it a little more challenging for that to be in your face all the time, as is often the case with content like that.
That's a great suggestion, Jethro, because you know we. God, when you look at some of the stories that come out in this venue, so much of it is because the websites literally are feeding harmful material, which is obviously harmful. This is not particularly complicated stuff. If you're feeding a teenage girl information on diet restriction to the point where they're developing bulimia, you know, I fail to understand what the social value of doing that is. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, at some point, there need to be people of conscience in these social media platforms who are willing to take steps that may not necessarily be in the best interests of their business model, but are socially worthwhile. And, you know, when you've got an executive from Instagram basically admitting that he would not allow his children to look at the content that Molly Russell looked at, then there's a problem, you know. Yeah. And yes, parents absolutely do have a responsibility. And I've long advocated that the first and most important censors, if you will, are parents in terms of what their kids look at. But clearly, social media companies and the people who work for them have a moral responsibility to pay more attention to this issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not enough to put in a couple policies and then be done with it. Like, we need constant, continued vigilance on it, and nothing less than that is acceptable in my mind.
I agree with you. Well, you know, and I think that this underscores the point that you and I have made in a number of shows, which is that the longer a child's access to social media can be delayed, honestly, the better. Yes. It's just the downside seems at this stage, without better control of the algorithms, the downside seems much greater than the upside. I mean, they will absolutely catch up with their peers in terms of knowing how to use social media and so forth when they're old enough to really appreciate the risks of what's online. But, you know, the idea that you're going to have 13 and 14 year old kids on these social media platforms, particularly if they're not necessarily being supervised on a regular basis, seems wildly risky.
Yes, for sure. I think the last thing that I'd like to say is just a reminder to, if you know someone who's struggling with depression or mental health issues or suicidal ideation, then to reach out to get help from professionals. And they're, like Fred said earlier in the show notes, there are all kinds of places to go to get that. And here in the United States, 988, put that in your phone, program it in so that you can help those who are struggling, and be ready to support them. And I think that's what we all need, is people to help us and support us. Because as much as we may want the social media companies to change things, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to, unfortunately.
Well, God knows that is the truth, Jethro. And I think that, you know, this feels personally like a very important show, because we're, you know, raising kids, a generation of kids who are so deeply immersed in all of this. And it's going to take careful observation and outreach from all of us to make sure that they navigate that safely. And again, if you can delay your child's onboarding to social media, really give that some serious thought. Might be worthwhile giving a shout out to the paperback/ebook, Raising Cyber Ethical Kids. And of course, you and I did a mini course based on that. So we'll throw the link into the show notes for that. But it's got some good suggestions on how to navigate these issues and develop the level of conversation that can help mitigate potential problems.
Absolutely. Good. Thanks for bringing this topic up, Fred. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, it's a tough one, and we'll have some slightly cheerier topics to look forward to. Yes. Definitely want to give a shout out to next month's talk about the cyber traps of Halloween costumes for educators. That's always a fun topic, and we'll be previewing the upcoming trip to PPI next week. So,
yeah, excellent.
Turn gears. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Cyber Traps podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll continue our coverage of emerging trends in a variety of areas, including digital misconduct, cyber safety, cybersecurity, privacy, digital psychology, I guess, and the challenges of high-tech parenting. Along the way, we'll talk to a growing collection of international experts who are helping us to understand the risks and the rewards of digital technology.
You can find the Cyber Chaps podcast on all of your favorite podcast apps. We hope that you'll share the show with your friends and colleagues and reach out to us if you have guest, question, or topic suggestions. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Jethro Jones and Fred is at Cyber Chaps. And if you're still listening, you must have loved this show. Please leave us a 5-star rating and share this with your friends. We appreciate having you with us and look forward to having you join us on our next episode.
Do you want to save time on prep work, increase student achievement for all of your students, reliably meet Tier 1 standards? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/B to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.